I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Last week, a Kansas City Star series about the Kansas government's obsession with secrecy was named a Pulitzer Prize finalist, but getting a little sunshine into the halls of power is easier said than done. Today, we sit down with one of the reporters involved in the series and an advocate for open government in Kansas for an update on where efforts to increase transparency in the state stand now. Also, April's National Donate Life Month, highlighting the need for donors. We'll meet two men who can teach us what life is like waiting for an organ transplant. One has received a donated kidney, the other is waiting for a new heart. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Kansas has one of the darkest state governments in the nation, so concluded a series in the Kansas City Star last year that was just named a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize in Public Service. The series put a new word, transparency, into the lexicon beneath the Capitol Dome in Topeka, and it's resulted in a slew of bills proposed this session to put more sunlight into the state's very dark culture. But now, with just days to go in the 2018 session, many of those bills are languishing and hopes for their passage are fading. Here to give us an update on progress on transparency in Kansas are Laura Bauer. She is one of the lead Kansas City Star reporters on this project, along with Judy Thomas. And Laura, nice to have you. Good morning.
Good morning.
Max Couch is a media lawyer and a board member of the Kansas Sunshine Coalition for Open Government. Max, good morning.
Morning.
And I should point out that I work at the Star as a member of the editorial board. Laura, how did you find out that your series had been named a finalist in the public service category for the esteemed Pulitzer Prize?
We had heard rumors that we were in the mix, and that was exciting enough. You know, if you're being talked about with New York Times and Washington Post and The New Yorker, we were pretty much good. But it was a couple days before when we were thinking maybe we did have a shot, and then it wasn't until that Monday that we knew for sure. And everybody, you know, I wanted to see it first and not just hear it, so I kept making sure that I was refreshing, and it took a while to come up, but then we all were
This is the
excited.
Day the awards were announced, and you were watching the results coming in. So how big a thrill was this? And by all means, congratulations.
Oh, yeah. Thank you. So many people worked on it, and we worked really hard. You know, reporters across the state had noticed this, as well as Max and other Freedom of Information attorneys knew for years that there were pieces of darkness, if so to speak, throughout Kansas. What we were able to do is show that it was really a blanket of secrecy. And so when you're able to do that, and we open the eyes of so many people across the state, legislators among them, when you're able to do that, that's so gratifying. And when you see the impact, but then when you're talked about and basically come in second place to the New York Times and New Yorker for journalism's top prize across the country, it was pretty amazing. But I will say one of the biggest things for us and the most gratifying is the impact the series has made. And so just as you watch the awards and you watch them come in and you are excited about it, no bigger thrill than when the House unanimously passed the bill disclosure law for DCF.
Yeah.
Because that is one of the biggest things, one of the
bigger
pieces.
Department of Children and Family Services you're talking about.
Right.
Yeah, we'll talk about that in a few minutes.
Yeah. So it's been great, and you know, all the different reporters and the editors, and Chick Halland was a projects reporter. Mike Fannin did a whole bunch of work on this.
Editor of the paper.
Editor,
yeah.
And then Judy Thomas and I kind of, you know, that big story, the first story, and then Judy worked on the Gut and Go with Brian Lowry, and then I did DCF, and those were the first three, and then Kelsey Ryan, Andy Marceau, Steve Vakrat, and Max Lomberg. Everybody came together to make it work. So that was great.
You know, Max, as a board member for the Kansas Sunshine Coalition for Open Government, do you view Kansas as one of the country's least transparent states? Is that what we got on our hands here?
Well, I think so. My research does indicate that. You know, it's not just the Kansas Open Records Act either, although there are problems there in terms of the vast amount of discretion that's given to to the agencies to determine whether or not to turn over a record. But we can, you know, as Laura mentioned, there's this quilt. And so the quilt of darkness includes things like the fact that Kansas has a very weak initiative and referendum law. It's very difficult for citizens in the state to, to gather signatures and to put measures on ballots. It shouldn't be that hard. It is hard in Kansas. Another good example is election audits. If you don't show up within 5 days and follow a very specific statutory procedure, you're not going to be able to challenge the outcome of elections. Those are just two examples that go beyond the Kansas Open Records Act to suggest that.
You know, Max, one thing I'm wondering, and I want to get Laura to chime in here too, is why is Kansas so lacking in transparency? Because at least on one level, the culture of the state, you know, anti-slavery, pro-women in public office, wouldn't suggest a state that favors secrecy in state government.
Well, you know, that is an excellent question. I've looked at it from a historical perspective. What you are suggesting is a brand of populism that we associate with Williams Jennings Bryan and 1896 and all that
William
sort of
Ellen
thing.
William Ellen White and all the great figures, you know, Bob Dole and Nancy Kassebaum, for that matter.
Yeah. Absolutely, I think that, and I need to follow up on this, but my understanding is that there are essentially two brands of populism, and one brand of populism that has entrenched itself in the state of Kansas is dependent on authoritarianism to some extent, and I can't cite enough to be able to truly back that up. But I can say that that it's manifested itself, for example, in the Kansas Open Records Act. The Kansas Open Records Act was passed in 1984, offers all of this discretion to law enforcement, for example, in a nod to authoritarianism and discretion, because authoritarianism is goes right to discretion. You'll give the discretion to the authority versus a democracy, which would have some sort of actual legal standards. The United States Supreme Court and all the reported cases. I mean, that's what we're trying to get to, and unfortunately, the Kansas laws related to transparency afford so much discretion and not enough legal standard.
You know, Laura Bauer, there are a lot of other states I might pick out of a hat before I would Kansas for being so dark. What's your theory?
You know, I started looking at it more than a year and a half ago, just with child welfare. And so I would ask legislators, why is there so much secrecy? And even before the series. And it was Senator Molly Baumgartner who said, we're just a private people here in Kansas. And people believe what's my business is my business and it's not yours, so stick out, stay out.
Do you buy that theory?
Well, I believe when I've talked to other legislators, they truly believe it. And when our series ran, 2 days later, I went to Topeka because there was a child welfare hearing. There was a conservative Republican, I won't name, who came up and people were talking about the series, and he said it was the most pathetic, worthless reporting he'd ever seen. And he didn't believe it. And so I do believe that there are people in the state that just believes, you know, we're doing God's work, nothing to see here. Move away, and I really see it in so many. We're seeing it a little bit in DCF with a new leader. I think it's going to take more than one person to
the
change
new leader
the culture.
Who's saying she's going to change the culture in the Department of Children and Family Services.
I will say that since the series ran, there was a little boy that I wrote about in the DCF story, Caleb Blancett, and his mother stabbed him to death 7 times, and he died. We tried to get the records beforehand. We're trying to get the records after. The bill is $1,250. And, you know, why is it $1,250?
So that's actually copy the records and turn them over to the Kansas City Star.
Max and I were talking about this before. I mean, and it's, you know, just, you know, but then you have Missouri that their disclosure law for child welfare is up to one person and one person only, and that's a director of social services. 9 times out of 10, if not more than that, every time we ask for records, we get them. Not a big hefty fee either. And so I do think it's a culture. But I also believe that there are some lawmakers. I mean, anybody who follows Stephanie Clayton or Brett Parker on Twitter.
Local lawmakers from Johnson County.
Yeah, I mean, they are. If you want to know what's going on, don't wait for your reporters to tell you. Just follow their Twitter feed because they believe in that. There are lawmakers who are catching on and who want. Jared Owsley is another one. They're really trying to be open.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Up to Date, and we're talking this morning about the lack of transparency in Kansas, coming off of a series the Kansas City Star ran last year, just named a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize in Public Service. Max, what's the biggest problem right now? If you had to point to one thing when it comes to lack of transparency, what would you finger?
Well, the broad answer is too much discretion is being afforded to the agencies.
They can decide what records to release, and that's where it lies.
And not only that, they can decide how much to charge. Laura is illustrating an instance of $1,250. Most states and the federal government in the Freedom of Information Act don't allow for agencies to charge for staff time. The staff time option that is given to the agencies to charge for staff time can have a very chilling effect, because then it'll end up be cost prohibitive for the member of the public or the member of the media to get the information. Another good example of this discretion comes in criminal investigation records. In Missouri, after 10 years, after a no charging decision has been made or after all appeals have been exhausted, then those criminal investigation records are categorically available to the public. Mm-hmm. Whereas in Kansas, it is basically exactly the opposite, where there is no time limit, no limit whatsoever on when a law enforcement agency can decide, hey, we're not going to turn these over. Mm-hmm. So, what is hard for me to grasp is that Kansas City is a border city. All right. So if a crime takes place in Missouri, then you're going to be able to get the records. And if it took, one block across state line mm-hmm. road, you wouldn't. Would the world end if Kansas's law were the same as Missouri's? I mean, why hasn't the world ended in Missouri?
Yeah. Laura, what would be the one thing you would point to as the biggest example, most glaring example of a lack of transparency?
I think I'm going to channel former Representative John Rubin. And he was very helpful when we did our
series.
He's
from Shawnee, a Republican from Shawnee. He's been on the show many times.
And we had a couple town halls after the series ran. And in the first one, he said, one word for you, leadership. And that leadership in Topeka, legislative leadership, if they do not want a bill to come forward, it doesn't. If they don't want certain things to be talked about, it isn't. I do think that, and we've seen that, and we have seen that since the story ran, that people are telling us that leadership is not ready for a culture of openness. Mm-hmm. And that's not my opinion. That's what we're hearing from other people. And you have seen it. We, shortly after the series ran, Speaker Reichman issued an order that everyone applauded that said no more anonymous bills, that when lawmakers had a bill that they would put their name on it or the requester's name on it.
Which seems like basic political science 101, right?
Right.
Who's behind an idea in the legislature? We should know who that is.
Right, yeah. And you talk about culture. Anonymous bills go back 1910. I mean, this is not a Brownback thing. This is not a new thing. This goes way back. But they're also being used, like 94% of the bills last year were anonymous.
So has that changed?
Well, Judy and I went and picked... from one House calendar one day, we looked at every bill, and I think there were 73 of them. And we found, and my numbers are a little off, but we found, I think, 61 that still didn't have a name on it. And they said it was an IT issue. After we initially...
An IT issue.
Yeah, that they have to put it into the computer, so people have to do that, and they were working with IT. And then shortly after we talked to them, I looked a couple days later because the story hadn't run yet, and they had added names on about 18. And do I think that there is a push to be more transparent? I do. Do I think that it's going to take many more baby steps than I think some people realized? Yes. There's no giant leap here.
Max, this is really astonishing to me. Again, you're talking to a reporter here of many years, but the notion that you can't find out who is sponsoring a bill, the person pushing an idea in the legislature, that's going to cause a lot of people out there to shake their heads. It's causing me to shake my head. That's amazing to me.
Well, it's amazing to me too.
I covered the legislature for a while. Yeah,
and I the bills that I've had. That I have been focusing on, the vast majority of those absolutely do not name anybody. If at most they might name a committee, but I would say this: the culture. top down does help to some extent. And when Collier, when Governor Collier was elected, or elected when he was took when he took over when he was inaugurated, you know, he had these transparency initiatives that he wanted to get going.
Has he helped?
And I don't think there's any doubt that if you have the top down, we're going to do this a certain way, I think it can't help but trickle down in some ways. And, you know, in his press release, it said, transparency is the key to better accountability, and accountability is the key to real results.
Hmm.
And, you know, those
can't
are the—
get much stronger than that.
No, you can't. And that's on the governor's website, you know, they just pulled it up just now.
Right.
And you know, that's not the kind of message we would have gotten from the previous administration. So to me, that's a step in the right direction.
So how much difference has the Star Series made, at least in your estimation?
Well, we can't go back in time and see what would have happened, but are we sure that the new governor would have initiated these changes and made these sort of statements without that? You know, transparency being a buzzword at the Capitol was something that was new for me and open government advocates, and for it to have, you know, even if with school finance things haven't been gotten as many things done as we would have liked, just the mere fact that that word and that transparency and that it even evoked the kind of response that you got from that conservative legislator to mm-hmm. attack you, you know, mm-hmm. I mean, those are that I think that goes to show that this is an issue that is going to continue to gain traction.
The lack of transparency in Kansas is our issue. Our phone number here, 816-235-2888. You can tweet us at KCUR up to date. Let's go to Leslie from Mission Hills, who's been waiting for a bit. Leslie, good morning.
Good morning, Steve. Good morning, everybody. It is a difficult and tractable issue. You're talking about it from sort of the top side. How do we push to open the people who have the powers to do so? The other concern that I have is that people reading about this feel like, there you go, government's corrupt. The people who have the power are not going to loosen the reins lightly. And you can't allow, you know, sort of the self-defeating element to take over. And there are many advocacy groups that work on it, but just to inject another topic, Medicaid expansion in Kansas is a big issue. There are a lot of very well-connected groups that have formed together, the Alliance for Healthy Kansas, and, you know, they can't get going. Why? Because committee chairs who oversee these things will sort of block legislation. So you may have a Stephanie Clayton or a Jared Owsley or one of the other legislators put up a good idea on election reform or whatever, but let's stick with the Medicaid issue, and it doesn't go anywhere. Why? Because the committee structure in the legislature is very tough. So you have executive branch issues for sure, but you have, you know, these problems on the legislative side. And sometimes it's not, we know who the committee chairs are, but again, those power reins are not going to be loosed lightly.
Yeah.
And people can't be, and you can't feel dejected. You just have to keep, you know, banging away at it. So I thank the STAR for doing the work. And, you know, there are a lot of ways for people to get involved at the grassroots level to keep at it. But that's what has to happen. And it's a long baby step, as you said, step thing. There is no giant panacea.
Leslie, thanks for the
good call.
Thanks
for talking about it.
Appreciate it. Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, Laura Bauer, before you go, I wanted to ask you about a couple specific areas here when it comes to transparency and the lack of it in Kansas. How about the deaths of children under state supervision? What changes have you seen? Where do we stand with that today? Because this is for the ability of newspapers and TV stations and radio stations to get information about the deaths of children in state supervision that hasn't been provided thus far.
Right. It started out as a House bill, and believe it or not, they used gut and go on it, and now it's Senate Bill 336. And
explain what gut and go is.
Where's Judy? Basically, a chamber can pass a bill, and normally it's not a consequential bill. It's just they use them as vehicles. So they can pass this bill, and then when it goes to the other chamber, gut everything out of it and put something in it that sometimes is controversial, as you know from your time at the State House. Then they put a controversial bill in there, and it doesn't have to then it goes to the second chamber, but it never receives another hearing in the other chamber.
Mm-hmm.
And so it cuts out the public, basically.
Yeah.
And so sometimes it's used for good. I mean, that's how the Child Welfare Task Force was even formed, is through a gut and go. But this bill, and I think the public is starting to realize how important this is. We mm-hmm. have many high-profile deaths in Kansas of children dying. These are not children in foster care, so it's not on the necessarily the contractors, because everybody wants to say private system. This is an investigative issue because they're in the home. And when a child dies, like when Adrian Jones died in KCK and his body fed to pigs, there was a wait of a year and a half to get those records. Mm-hmm. And we knew that from sources.
A year and a half.
And here's the big thing on that, which I don't know if everybody realizes. Many of these cases have patterns in them where there is one policy or one procedure that failed, and then it's going to go on to the next kid. Mm-hmm. In a year and a half, there's a hole in a safety net that allowed a child's body to be fed to pigs. That safety net has a hole in it, and if you wait for a year and a half to get that information out, to know, have the public know, other kid can fall through it.
Yeah.
So this bill is so important, and I think people are realizing it, and it's in conference committee right now. It's passed both chambers, and what it would do is after the death of a child of abuse or neglect, we would know the age of that child, when the child died, and whether there were hotline calls, what the findings of those hotline calls were, and what services the family was provided by the state.
So a real way to check on how effective the state was in terms of looking after this child.
Yes. Information, mind you, we typically get in Missouri. This is not information that...
This is not breaking new ground across the country. This is basic stuff.
This is basic stuff. Some states give it, some don't. Yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And when Adrian died and we tried to get information from Missouri, they were ready to give it to us. And it was when they made a call to Wyandotte County that the Unified Government Police did not want us to have it because it would hurt their case. But it didn't hurt the case of LP, the little girl in the attic, or in the closet in Missouri. And so it's again, goes to what Max is talking about, this law enforcement and struggle to give information.
Sally from Lawrence, you're on Up to Date. Sally, we're talking about the lack of transparency in Kansas. Good morning.
Good morning. I just wanted to point out that there's a correlating problem here that exacerbates this, which is that there's not data available, readily available, and it's an intentional decision in many respects to not keep the information in a way in which you can evaluate patterns and look at just the data on things. You have to look at specifics and know what to ask for, and so a lot of agencies aren't providing that. One example is the forfeiture laws. You can't tell how many millions of dollars different counties are making in forfeiture because they put all that money into their funds in a the way that they do it.
This is when law enforcement seizes an automobile, for instance, as a result of a drug case, Sally, and the county can actually take possession of that car and sell it for its own benefit. Those are the kinds of information you're talking about here. Yeah,
exactly. They make millions of dollars, and if you look at all the public information available, you can't assess the difference between fines and forfeitures and get even the basic issues of how many are there, what's
right.
the range of value, that kind of thing. And the same thing applies in this child welfare.
Right. Sally, thank you.
Which is why she has to do so much work.
I appreciate
thank
it.
You.
Max, I got to wrap up here, but if we don't see lots of changes this year, how worried are you that we're going to lose momentum for in the years to come to actually get these changes made long after the Star series would have run?
Well, the phrase that we often use at Sunshine Coalition is chipping away. And
yeah.
so
I'm hearing that refrain throughout this conversation.
And so the commitment to continuing to do that is what cannot wane. There's a body cam bill that is getting set to pass, we think, and we think that the remaining issues related to transparency of
police body camera footage.
Mm-hmm. The plan is to discuss those things in Judicial Council over the summer to continue to gain traction towards perhaps rewriting some open records laws. So all of the negotiations, the attempts to pass bills, I think it always looks to the future. Trying to accomplish things in the civilian legislature that's only meeting for 4 months is a hard thing to do, and I think it's important to keep the pressure on through the media and through the quote unquote professionals in Topeka, you know, the Attorney General, the Governor, you know, KBI, you know, these agencies that have employees there year round, and try to create enough pressure so that when the legislators do get there, that they know that this is important to Kansas voters.
That's Max Couch. He's a media lawyer and a board member of the Kansas Sunshine Coalition for Open Government. He was joined today by Laura Bauer, one of the lead Kansas City Star reporters on this open government lack of transparency project in Kansas. She was a finalist for this year's Pulitzer Prize in Public Service. Thank you both for a good conversation. Sure appreciate it.
Thank you.
Time for a break. When we come back, we'll talk about organ transplants and what's it like to wait for one of those things and the agony you go through. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And welcome back to the second half of Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. I spoke to organizers of AIDS Walk KC on yesterday's program, and we met a man living with HIV. We spoke about the difference the charity has been making in Kansas City for 30 years. You can hear that conversation at kcur.org/up-to-date. And tune in tomorrow. We'll travel back in time to learn how French traders' arrival in the West Bottoms changed life forever for the Native Americans who called that area home. That's tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, what's life like waiting for an organ transplant? Just how tenuous can life be? April is National Donate Life Month, and the month was designed to encourage people to register as donors. There's good news on that front. Nearly 35,000 transplants were performed in 2017 across the country using organs from both deceased and living donors. That was a new record for organ transplants in the U.S. But many more organs are needed. Organ transplants, what it's like living with one, what it's like waiting for one, is our subject today. With us today, Brendan Connors received a kidney transplant in 2017. Brendan, welcome.
Hey.
You're a young guy. How old are you?
I'm 24.
Great. Sam Mansour has received a bridge treatment to help him wait for a heart transplant. He went on the transplant list earlier this month. Sam, nice to have you. Welcome.
Thank you.
Also with us is Dr. Sean Coomer. He's Vice President of Operative Services and a transplant surgeon at the KU Medical Center. Dr. Coomer, nice to have you. Welcome.
Thanks for having us.
Well, Sam, you're waiting for a new heart. What's that wait like for you?
Actually, the wait itself, I'm anxious, of course.
Yeah.
I can't wait to get a new heart. However, the transition over since I've had the operation has been phenomenal.
You had this thing called a bridge treatment. What is that?
Not to be overly dramatic, but when I went in, I was literally dying. And after the surgery and so on, it's a machine that's connected to my heart, which I carry with me.
It's with you right now.
It is with me right now. I carry
it. It's keeping
it
you alive.
It is keeping me alive. And the transition has been absolutely phenomenal simply because I went in not being able to breathe and now everything has changed.
And the machine does what exactly?
I believe, as far as I understood it, forgive me for my
ignorance.
These
are complicated things, yeah.
It pumps most of the blood to my valves and so on, I believe, doctor.
It does the work that your heart might be doing.
Yes.
Is that right, Dr. Coomer?
That's correct. It's a ventricular assist device, so it assists the weakened muscle of the heart, essentially.
Yeah. You know, Sam, you had your first heart surgery 10 years ago for extreme heart failure. Tell us about that, because it sounds like you've been through the mill here.
I have been. I was born with it, and I had it with at KU 10 years ago, and then it slowly became worse and worse until I finally went in and I saw Dr. Sauer approximately over 8 months ago.
Right. Well, how long do you think it's going to be before you might get a new heart?
I'm praying tomorrow.
It could be tomorrow?
As far as I understood it, it could be tomorrow, it could be next week, it could take longer. It all depends because, of course, the procedure is extremely tenuous, to say the least, and they have to match everything to be just to get it as perfect as possible.
Are you on a waiting list? Like, do you have a number right now?
I don't have a number, but I was put on the list approximately 2 weeks ago.
Dr. Coomer, how long do you think it'll take?
It's hard to say. Every organ is different in how it's allocated, you know, whether it be kidney, liver, heart, pancreas, et cetera. And they all have different statuses, and some are a wait in line based on time, and heart has to do a little bit more with how sick the patient is.
And who decides then whether, you know, Sam is going to get his heart or if it's going to be somebody in Toledo, Ohio who gets that heart?
Right.
Who makes these decisions?
Oh, that's a good question. Folks are put on the list, candidates are put on the list based on their blood type, also what they match, and then it comes up based in need and necessity, essentially. So it's a national list run through United Network of Organ Sharing, which is out of Richmond, Virginia. So it's a national list, and it gets run based on that.
Do you have a lot of faith in that organization?
Absolutely. It's run it for years and done a nice job.
Yeah. You know, Sam mentioned this sense of having to match his body type with the right heart. Tell us about that. What are we talking about there?
So when you're talking about that, you're talking about the immune system, whether the immune system will line up correctly, number one. Number
and you can
two,
find that out ahead of time?
Absolutely. Absolutely. So you're testing both the donor and recipient, see if they match in virtual cross-match, essentially. And blood type also matters. Also, the quality of the organ matters. And also size. So you can't have a very small heart in an adult male like Sam.
Mm-hmm. You know, I remember when I was a kid and watching Dr. Christian Barnard, am I saying that right?
Yes, that's true.
Who did the first heart transplant in the 1960s. And as a little boy, Life magazine had this big photo spread, and you could see pictures of this, and it was just absolutely fascinating to me. But I remember it wasn't one of the big issues back in those days, Doctor, this notion that will the body reject the heart or not? And I'm just guessing here that maybe that's one of the advancements that's been made over the years, that you can tell ahead of time whether a body will do that or not.
Absolutely. So one of the biggest advances really was in the 80s when immunosuppression, anti-rejection drugs became so good and efficacious. That really changed the whole transplant community completely.
Mm-hmm. So bottom line then, Sam, your life these days is you're living on tenterhooks then, right? Sort of just waiting and hoping.
I am, but I am fully functional. And
how do you feel? I was going to say.
I feel fantastic. And again, the difference between when I first went in to how I feel now, again, from the breathing to the walking to being able to sleep to the bloating, all of it has completely gone completely. It changed, completely changed. And the difference is absolutely phenomenal, and not to be overly dramatic, but it really has been for me.
Okay, so Sam is waiting for a new heart. Brendan Connors received a kidney transplant in 2017. Brendan, how's that going for you? Because you look great.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I'm working out as usual, but yeah, I'm doing pretty good.
Are you an athlete? Because you look like you could be.
Yeah, I actually did play football and basketball back in college and high school.
Can you still do that, or are those days over?
Absolutely.
Really?
Yep.
And what are you doing along those lines now?
Basically, I'm just playing basketball, pick up games with friends, lifting every day like this morning. And just keeping active as usual.
Yeah. Tell us about how you found out that you needed a new kidney. What happened in your life?
Well, I'll keep it brief. So I found out that I had a chronic kidney disease. So what that does is my kidneys decrease over time, and I found out when I was young. Once I graduated college, 2017, that's when I knew that my kidneys were starting to fail. I needed to start
How could you tell?
Basically, what I do is I go in and I get lab draws. They check out my GFR, which is my kidney function.
The old GFR.
Yeah.
Yeah, who knew? Yeah.
Coomer can talk about it a lot better. But yeah, GFR, they look at that and they see my creatinine level as well.
Sure.
Yeah, so that's waste in the body that they're looking at as well.
But did you feel okay, or was it just
simply
a number on a sheet of paper?
I felt fine. It was a number. Yep.
Yeah. At what point did they come and tell you that, hey, bucko, you got to get a new kidney altogether here?
January is when they were just telling me I need to start looking at dialysis and talking to people about living donation.
Mm-hmm.
So it was more towards the summer, June. My GFR was like at 8% functioning. My kidneys were functioning about 8% at that time.
Yeah.
So that was when I really needed to start buckling down on it.
How long did you have to wait for the kidney then?
I waited less than a year, so I was actually, it was
less than
nice
a year, that's a long time though.
Yeah, it's a long time, but the average is about 3 years if I'm right. 3 years for people who are waiting on the waiting list, and I was blessed to have my cousin be my living donor, Kyle Baldwin, so.
Yeah, and a cousin can designate that he wants his kidney to go to you then, right?
Mm-hmm.
And there were a lot of matches there because of the family and everything else, yeah. So your message to people listening here about kidney donation or any kind of organ donation would be what? Clearly the need is dramatic, because I'm looking at two of you who are in this situation. Yeah,
absolutely. I think it's important. Again, it's to give up something like that, it's extreme, and you really have to think about it and be serious about it. But everybody has loved ones that they know that have to go through something like that. So
yeah. So do you have just one operative kidney now?
Yes, I actually have three, and I have one good working one. And
you have three inside of you?
Yes, right now.
Yeah. Cool. That's got to be so yeah. cool. What a thing you can say at the bars, right?
Yeah.
You have three kidneys. Yeah, yeah. yeah. And Sam, what would your message be to people listening out there about the importance of thinking about organ donation going forward?
Well, you're given the gift of life, and it's I don't think there's a greater gift that anyone can give. And that's exactly what it is. You're giving someone else a chance to live again.
Yeah.
And to me, that's I cannot stress it any further than that. I think that's the greatest gift that we have, and that's the greatest gift that any human being can give to another.
So, Dr. Coomer, you know, one of the questions here then is, why aren't more people doing this? You know, what is it that's holding our society back from being more aggressive when it comes to opening ourselves up to these possibilities?
Well, there are a lot of different reasons. A lot of it comes down to awareness and education, I think.
Sure.
I think that getting the word out really matters. There are some – this region has a lot of – grassroots organization about donor awareness. Gift of Life works on that locally. Also, we're blessed with Midwest Transplant Network.
I got a caller from Gift of Life we'll get to in just a
Great.
Moment here.
Yeah. And Midwest Transplant Network also is a very aggressive and good organ procurement agency in the area. So this region has a lot of giving people. This area and this region has one of the highest conversion rates and donor rates in the entire country.
What does that mean, conversion rates?
It means that when somebody actually becomes a donor, or they're eligible to be a donor, they actually fulfill and become a donor.
Mm-hmm.
So they're very aggressive about doing that and providing organs to people that are dying from end organ disease.
So how do you do it? Again, if our listeners are thinking about, okay, I need to get on the stick here and make myself available for an organ donation, what do they do?
Well, I mean, one of the easiest things is you can do this at the DMV. You can get online at donor network and alliances and so forth and just register. That's the first thing to do.
And it's an online thing.
You can so do online as well as DMV.
You don't want to think about it, but if the time would ever come when you'd be in a situation to donate, then what, the ambulance guy goes online and sees that you're a donor care.
Yeah, absolutely. And a discussion needs to happen before you get in that crisis with your family member. You want to tell your family members, I want to be a donor if this unfortunate accident does happen to me.
Mm-hmm.
Those discussions need to happen up front.
Yeah. Let me go to Diane here. Again, she's with the Gift of Life organization. Diane, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Sure. Tell me about the Gift of Life. What do you guys do?
Well, we have two signature programs. We're a local organization here. One is a high school educational program, which Sean just described a little bit, where we go into the high schools and we teach the high school students about the importance of being an organ donor and having that conversation with their loved ones.
But because a high school student, that's a very attractive donor because of the relative youth of the person, right?
Yes, and also because sometimes it's the first time that they're really thinking about being an organ donor when they go to the DMV to get their license for the first time.
Okay. And go ahead. I cut you off. Yeah.
The other program we have is called Transplant Mentors. And what we do is we match healthy and thriving transplant recipients with patients who are new to the transplant list, with the patients themselves and their family members and caregivers. And these are trained volunteers who've had the same organ transplanted, usually at the same hospital, and they're of similar background and gender and age. And what these mentors are trained to do is not to give medical advice, but because they've walked in the same shoes as these patients and these family members, they can really provide firsthand insight and encouragement to everyone involved.
Yeah. Well, I was wondering, as you look back at your own situation, Brendan, I mean, you said you don't feel differently today than you used to before, right?
Yeah, I mean, I feel a little bit. When I was playing basketball with friends and such, I would get fatigued a lot quicker. I can keep up a little bit more now and actually surpass them. But
yeah.
Yeah.
Are you involved in the program that Diane mm-hmm. is talking to people who are on the list for
yes.
receiving?
Yep.
Who tell me about some of the people you visited.
Well, I haven't visited anybody else except for my younger brother, mm-hmm. who's going to have a transplant next month. But
what's he need a transplant for? kidney also?
Yeah, kidney as well. So we both have the same disease, chronic kidney disease, and his is scheduled May 29th. But yeah, I've talked to him. He was upset at first, just kind of eased him and let him know about more information about it and everything.
What was the recovery for you like?
It was kind of painful for me just because I couldn't be active, do the stuff that I like to do.
So it wasn't physically painful as it was mentally painful.
No, I mean, I know Dr. Schmidt, Dr. Kummer are kind of rough, but they're okay. but no, it wasn't physically pain.
Yeah. Hey, how will it be for Sam, Dr. Kummer, as he goes about receiving a new heart here? Again, this is a phenomenal thing that just in my lifetime, we went from the first heart transplants to how routine is this these days?
It's extremely routine. I mean, this is happening every day throughout the entire country and even the world and all different kinds of organs. I mean, the strides been made over the past, 50 years is incredible. When it comes to transplantation.
Is the actual physical operation itself, is it complicated to transplant a heart?
Well, sure. I mean, any kind of operation comes with risk and technical issues and so forth. But, in Sam's case, he has a VAD. He has an assist device. So going back into his chest is a reoperation. So just like there's a scar on the outside, there's a scar on the inside. So it complicates it, but we certainly have excellent surgeons that encounter this on a daily basis.
So what's the toughest thing about transplanting a heart? I mean, what's the toughest moment when you're doing that operation?
Yeah, and I'm only speaking from, speaking of my colleagues. I'm not a cardiac surgeon, so I wouldn't presume to speak for them. But certainly, you're taking an organ from ice and not beating to make it blood in it again and beating again. And it's exhilarating as a surgeon, and
to see that thing kickstart again.
Absolutely.
And get moving again.
Any organ, yes.
Yeah, do you do kidneys?
I do liver and kidneys primarily, and pancreas.
Yeah. And what's the hardest part about doing a kidney?
Well, I mean, honestly, I always describe it to folks as it's plumbing. It's just fancy plumbing. We're hooking, a kidney. You're hooking an artery, a vein, and a ureter. So you're just sewing three pipes together. So I know it simplifies it a little bit. There's a little bit more to that, but nonetheless, it's just plumbing.
Yeah. Diane, what else would you want people to know who are listening out here about what they might think about doing to get on a donor list here?
To get on the donor list? Again, like as Sean said, it's the most important thing really is to have a conversation with your family members and with your loved ones, because if, God forbid, something happens to you or to them, it makes that decision to become a donor much, much easier, much more palatable for the family.
Yeah. Diane, again, is with a group called Gift of Life. What's your website, Diane?
It's www.giftdonor.org.
Okay. I'm glad you called. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Let's go to Richard from Kansas City, Missouri, who had a lung transplant about 5 years ago. Richard, good morning.
Good morning.
How are you, Richard?
I'm happy to be here.
Yeah.
After five additional years, I was very lucky. I went downhill rather quickly. Lung transplants don't seem to be performed in the Kansas City area yet. I had to go to Houston Methodist, where some of the first transplants were performed. I think they also performed them over in St. Louis. But I found there to be a lack of awareness amongst the physicians that were attending me about the possibility of a lung transplant. And so that's why I wanted to call and pursue a greater awareness of lung transplants of being very successful means in my case, which was a fibrosis of the lungs. And
What does that mean?
My lungs were simply stiffening up. The tissue was becoming fibrous, and the transfer of gases wasn't taking place, so it's slow suffocation. And I had about 90 days to live, and which is a sobering moment for anyone, I think. And at any rate, lung transplant's a fantastic mechanism. They could immediately tell on the operating table that I was pinking up and doing great again. So I just want to get that encouragement out to folks to be aware that it exists, not here in Kansas City yet, but other locations are doing a lot of them.
Richard, thanks very much. I'm glad you're still with us, too.
Well, me too. Thanks a lot.
All right. You bet. Bye-bye. Dr. Kummer, of the four most common transplants, kidney, liver, heart, and lung, which one has the greatest need out there?
I think kidneys mostly.
Because why is that?
Well, in the United States, diabetes and hypertension are the main reasons for kidney failure. There are other reasons, such as Brendan has described in his case, but those are the main reasons. And as you know, diabetes and hypertension are certainly running rampant in our country.
Okay. We'll have to leave our conversation there, but I'm sure glad we did it. I'm going to thank our guests here again today. Brendan Connors received a kidney transplant back in 2017. Brendan, thanks very much. Glad to have you here.
Thank you.
Okay. And Sam Mansour received a bridge treatment to help him wait for a heart transplant. He's waiting for a new heart right now. Sam, we're pulling for you. All the best.
Thank you so much.
And Dr. Sean Coomer, Vice President of Operative Services and a transplant surgeon at KU Med Center, thanks very much. Sure appreciate it.
Thanks for
having us,
Steve.
All the best to you guys. You bet. Yesterday in the program, we learned why lead poisoning remains a big concern in the metro. You can hear my conversation with public health officials and other previous episodes. Just go to kcur.org/uptodate. You can find us on Twitter. We're at kcuruptodate. Follow me at Steve Kraske, and you can follow KCUR on Facebook. Tomorrow, we learn what it was like when Native American tribes called the West Bottoms home. Our show is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Kathleen Pointer, and Claire Verbeck. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.